This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan, New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. For information, check out nhhca.org as we welcome into the fold Paul Steinhauser. Paul, how are you?
Great to join you, Chris. Another busy week.
Yeah, we are about 4 months out from the First of the Nation presidential primary. We're going to have candidates signing up in just a couple weeks to be a part of the New Hampshire primary, and we're starting to get a little bit more of a feel for where the race is at. There's obviously significant questions and things going on at the top of the ticket. And we'll start with Joe Biden being here in New Hampshire this past week and the type of event that he had. Polls have him pretty much locked with Elizabeth Warren at this time. Warren with some upwards momentum, certainly at this point in time as well. What did you see from Biden? What do you sense in regards to his standing here in New Hampshire and in the other early primary states?
Joe Biden had a very short but very good trip to New Hampshire. What I saw was energy. I saw standing ovations for Joe Biden at his two events, the one in Rochester and the one in McIntyre Ski Area in Manchester. You normally don't see that. I saw a very energetic Joe Biden. He was on fire. I mean, of course, we know the news he made, but for those who may have missed it, let's recap. He, for the first time, said that Donald Trump needs to be impeached. So he joins about 9 or 10 other Democrats who are now on board with calling directly for the impeachment of Donald Trump. The former vice president making that announcement one day after the White House said they're not going to play ball with the House Democrats as they have this investigation, this inquiry into the vice president, which could lead towards a formal impeachment vote. So the vice president making his news in New Hampshire one day after the White House said that they would not be cooperating. And it was a very, very good trip for the former vice president. Again, the standing ovations, the energy, a full frontal attack on Donald Trump. He made a lot of news. He showed some energy for the first time in a while.
Yeah, I thought that that was key for him because the last trip we heard about him not having, you know, the necessary energy, you know, not having the necessary message, failing to motivate and captivate audiences. And this trip, it all changed for him. And obviously, there was something key that happened in between the last trip and this one, and that is the president and Ukraine and that investigation and where that has gone. And I see this as a tremendous opportunity for Biden because Biden has always needed Trump. And Trump right now is at the forefront of the conversation nationally and I think going to be at the forefront of the conversation in the debate coming up on Tuesday night and, you know, really probably for the rest of the primary as well. And it's not just Trump. It's also, you know, Trump's foreign policy, the decision that he made to abandon our Kurdish allies in Syria. And again, that's a Joe Biden forte, is foreign policy. He can speak well on the issues, hasn't always been on the right side of some of the issues, but can speak very, very well on those issues. So I think that the way the campaign appears to be headed at this point is beneficial to Biden, where in the past, there was a vacuum to be filled during the early months, and that vacuum was largely filled by Elizabeth Warren's policy proposals. And then we saw other campaigns basically following that lead and saying, oh, if it's working for Elizabeth Warren, we're going to start releasing in-depth policy proposals as well. So the race has shifted, in my view, to an environment that is more favorable for Biden.
And Chris, here's why, and we've been talking a lot about this on your daily show, 3, 2, 1. And Chris, we've been talking about this a lot on your show each morning. This really frames the election now between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. Why? Because impeachment is going to dominate everything. It's going to overshadow the race for the White House right now. What's impeachment about? Well, of course, it's about Donald Trump. But who's the secondary player in that? It's Joe Biden. So it almost frames this as a Biden-Trump general election matchup. And nobody, not Elizabeth Warren, not Bernie Sanders, his main two rivals, you know, can say that because they're not part of this impeachment story. Joe Biden is. Now, of course, there's a downside that this is a double-edged sword. It's all these allegations unsubstantiated from the president and his allies really saying, did Biden do something fishy when he was former vice president to help his son? But overall, this helps Joe Biden at the expense, really, of his rivals for the nomination.
And I think that it'll be interesting to see how that story develops. But, you know, here on Thursday, we saw two Rudy Giuliani associates arrested as they were trying to flee the country. And again, that story is, as you referenced, unsubstantiated. So there is that aspect of it, but I also feel like Joe Biden has already been painted by a broad brush in regards to Donald Trump, and there are questions that exist regardless of the claims being unsubstantiated, and there being really no evidence that's been produced at this point to indicate that there's any sort of a wrongdoing. So do you think that those unsubstantiated claims will have a negative effect on Biden in the primary process, or it'll be easy for him to move it aside, particularly given the fact that there's a large part of the Democratic electorate that is extremely uneasy about the relationship between big money and politicians and how that kind of permeates?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Overall, though, you know, these blasts by Donald Trump and Republicans at Joe Biden, I think most Democrats are kind of tuning them out. Why? Because they're coming from Donald Trump. But Fox News national poll out this week, interesting poll. We've had a lot of bad news for Donald Trump. For the first time, you had a majority, 51%, said it was time to not only impeach but remove Donald Trump from office. That's a very troubling number for Donald Trump. But there was also a troubling number for Joe Biden. 36% of those questioned said that they found it troubling, either extremely or very troubling, that when it came to those allegations, again, I'm just unsubstantiated, but when it came to those allegations against Biden, again, this is all about optics. So, yes, he could be burned a little bit by this, but again, Trump is the one who really gets hurt the most.
Speaking of the burn, let's go to Bernie Sanders.
Oh, what a segue, my friend.
And let's discuss a little bit about where things head for Bernie at this point. And I think it's largely still undefined. Bernie is going to be at the debate. That's what his campaign is saying on the 15th. He initially said that when asked after visiting his cardiologist that he was going to scale back the campaign, not participate in as many events, not to do as much stuff. And then he walked that back twice
this week. Yeah, I just wrote about this for Fox News today as we taped this show for Thursday evening. Yes, because the original news made a lot of headlines earlier in the week and sparked some speculation that maybe we wouldn't see such a frenetic pace from the senator from Vermont as we've seen in the past. And some people took it even a further step that wondered, well, maybe he's going to drop out. So first in an NBC News interview and second in a video that he sent out to supporters, to his huge, huge list of supporters, as he would say. The headline basically from him, from his mouth directly, was, "I'm feeling great. I'm getting more energetic every day. I'm going to be back on the campaign trail." He kind of stepped in it a little earlier in the week and he had to do a make do. But again, there are still questions. And this is never; these are not good optics for a 78-year-old candidate, the oldest presidential candidate in either side of this field.
So I feel that this has really changed the race, obviously, for Bernie Sanders, where, you know, he can say that he is going to be out there and that he's going to do the same things and he's going to be out there on the campaign trail as with the same type of vitriol and passion that he had in the past. But you know, we'll see how that plays out. And, you know, you also are concerned a little bit for Bernie's health in that you don't want him to do too much. And again, I'm going to be interested to see where the polling goes. First and foremost is Bernie's health. He's had a very difficult circumstance with his daughter-in-law passing. And, you know, talking about the politics and the horse race aspect of it feels kind of strange. But, you know, when an individual has had a heart attack, whether they are 45, 55, 65, or 75, it raises concerns about what the future will bring. And we're talking about, you know, a party selecting a Democratic nominee and going into a general election against Donald Trump. And then there's obviously the "and what" that occurs. Well, okay, well, what if Bernie has a setback while he is running against Trump in the general election? Then what happens after that? I just think that this has created a big concern around Bernie, and I think it's going to be very difficult for his campaign to move forward and have success because of the serious nature of what took place.
Here's
what
will help, though. Next week, Tuesday night, in Ohio at the fourth round of Democratic presidential primary debates, Bernie Sanders needs to be on his A game. Remember, in the last debate back in September, he had a hoarse voice. He wasn't feeling that good. It did not help. It just he couldn't make his case that effectively. He needs to be vibrant on that stage. That'll allay some of these concerns. Not all of them. It's not going away. But that will help. I think of all the candidates on the stage next week, Bernie Sanders probably has more at stake than anybody else because of what's happened.
I agree with that. I mean, I think that he has to prove a lot that night. But again, I'm not sure how much that's going to change things. As you noted before, you know, his polling numbers have gone down. And Bernie, in the interview I did, didn't necessarily want to agree with that. But his polling numbers have gone down. And his campaign cash is really strong. I don't think that his 15 to 20% support here in New Hampshire is going anywhere until he were to leave the race. So that base is going to be there for him. But again, the undecided voters, the people who are out there and are supporting Andrew Yang at this point, or supporting Elizabeth Warren, or just flat out undecided at this point, or folks that haven't entered the process yet. Bernie's pitch was going to be at the end that he was the safe, reliable person in this. He's fought the fights for many, many years, and that you should all come home now and realize that I'm the safe spot to land, and you know what you're going to get from me. And if you have, you know, concern about health, it's tough to still be that safe spot, the reliable spot where we know what we're going to get from Bernie Sanders. So we'll have a lot of questions answered, I think, in the next 4 months as we lead up to the primary. I think it's unfair to write him off completely at this point, but I think that there is obvious concerns for Bernie, how the campaign has handled this. They weren't forthcoming initially about the fact that he had a heart attack. He goes to see the cardiologist, and he says, we're going to scale back the campaign. And then there's a pushback, as there should be, because being president of the United States is not something that can be scaled back, and being a Democratic nominee is not something that can be scaled back. And I think the campaign initially should have just eased into this and said, this is what we're going to do, and we're going to make sure Bernie's health is first and foremost. We're not going to have any setbacks. And we're going to get back into the campaign. We might not go as vigorous early on, but we're going to ramp things back up. That should have been the way they went with this, health-wise and also strategy-wise. But instead, he came out and started talking about doing things differently. Then you have to switch the story again. Not great.
Hindsight, my friend. Hindsight. Yes, I wish. I bet Bernie Sanders wishes he had a little bit of hindsight. I'm not writing him off. He's still got plenty of campaign cash, got a ton of money. Got a good base of support here and in Iowa. But he's definitely a wounded warrior right now compared to where he was a few weeks ago.
That is Paul Steinhauser. I'm Chris Ryan. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. We talked with Michael Bennett, U.S. Senator for Colorado, this past week, and that conversation comes your way in a bit. Also, Joe Sestak, a really intriguing individual, one that has not really gotten any attention at all, despite the fact he's a former admiral in the Navy and a congressman from Pennsylvania. He joins us up next as well. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan with Paul Steinhauser. We're at the Barley House, where Michael Bennett met with some legislators and then talked with us, the senator from Colorado, talking about a couple things with us. And we started by talking about his standing in the race, which we'll hear in just a little bit, but also discussed Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, of course, talking about one of the co-frontrunners in the race for the Democratic nomination. And we were asking about basically whether she can be trusted by voters if she's truthful. We've seen, obviously, that she hasn't been so forthcoming with how she'll pay for her Medicare for All proposal. And also, in recent days, she's been facing some scrutiny over part of her stump speech when she talks about how she was fired as a teacher because she was starting to be noticeably pregnant. Here's what the senator said.
And hopefully that couldn't happen anywhere in America today. I don't have any knowledge about whether the stories are true or not, but here's what I would say. Having been the only candidate in this race who's won two national elections in a swing state that's exactly one-third Democratic, one-third independent, and one-third Republican, I know that voters think it matters whether you say one thing in the primary and another thing in the general election. And I always begin my races with the issues that I'm going to end my races with, because I think people want to know that their leaders are authentic and believe what they're saying to them. And that's what I'm trying to do in this primary as well. That's why I have been critical about the health care plans that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have put forth in this campaign. Bernie has been much clearer about how he would pay for it than Elizabeth has. He said there will be a massive tax increase on the middle class. She hasn't said that.
Do you feel that Elizabeth Warren has an issue with trust, whether it's not being as forthcoming as she could in regards to her Medicare for All plan, whether it's the story that Paul is referring to, whether it's her narrative? Is there an issue, do you think, that voters should have with her about what she says versus what the actuality is?
Look, we're all going to go through this x-ray of the soul, as they used to say about presidential campaigns. That's what this is going to be about. And I think the people that have been consistent and have been truthful about where they are going to stand up well. I had the other day, my daughter Caroline, when I first was thinking of running for president, she said, "Dad, if you run and you tell the truth and you lose, no one can fault you for it." And I said to her, "Caroline, that's good news, because there's no other reason for me to run, and it's the only way I think I can win." And like a month ago, the Des Moines Register ran an editorial with the headline that said, "Michael Bennett pounds truth into this campaign." And I was able to share that with my daughter and say, "Look, this is what I'm doing, and it is what I'm doing. The stuff I'm running on, I didn't concoct for this race. It's what I've been working on in a purple state for the last 10 years. It's what I think can not just unite Democrats, but allow us to win back some of the 9 million people who voted twice for Barack Obama and once for Donald Trump. That's what we have to do to win." So I do think it's important for us to be honest about our health care proposals.
I don't remember what the exact terminology was, but you basically referred to the three frontrunners as being fragile, and that at this point in the campaign,
that
you
their support is soft. Yeah,
soft, just fragile. So why do you think that is? Why are they? Why do you view them as being having soft support?
Because two reasons. One, I think it's all based on name recognition. If you look, not all, but a lot of it is based on name recognition. If you look at the way this field hasn't really changed since this campaign started, the reason for that is that we've been at very early stages of it. Now it's going to start to change because people are going to start to pay attention. And the second is my own polling shows it. And anecdotally, when I meet with people, people say we really haven't made up our minds. We respect the work that Joe Biden has done, but we wonder whether he's going to be there at the end of this race. I'm not saying me. I mean, this is what I'm hearing from people. And I think people know Elizabeth Warren well, because she's been a really good candidate. She's run a good campaign. But she's got better name recognition than everybody else. I think if history is any guide at all, it's folks that are in the bottom of this pack who are going to have the chance to rise, because people are going to decide that's our best chance for beating Donald Trump, and I think it is.
Michael Bennett right there, and also talked about his standing in the race. Here is a senator from Colorado, an individual that has a great background, knowledge, and expertise, but he's not going to be on the debate stage moving forward, and said he's given up on that pretty much. He's not going to launder money through Facebook anymore, as he references here. Here is more of our conversation with Senator Bennett. You have been waiting for a breakout moment to occur. You started with very low name ID. Take us through, you know, your thought process here about moving forward and the potential to still have that moment.
I really think that the voters in New Hampshire and in the other early states are just beginning to think about this. This is early. I think the support for the leaders in the race is very, very soft, maybe as soft as it's ever been at this stage of the race. And once you get past Bernie, so you go from Joe or from Elizabeth to Joe to Bernie or whatever the order happens to be on a given day, you get Mayor Pete on the way down, and then you've got a whole bunch of people that are between 0 and 3. And so at this stage, You know, I'm still polling low, but I'm polling higher than some of the people that are on the debate stage. And I think we've got a set of issues that we're running on that I think are going to resonate with the early voters in Iowa and New Hampshire, and we hope to do well in both places.
4 months till the voting begins in Iowa and here in New Hampshire. You're not making the debate stage. How do you get that message out?
Well, we're doing. I think in both Iowa and New Hampshire, I had to make a decision on the debate stage whether I was going to keep laundering money through Facebook to try to stay on a debate stage that was preseason football that wasn't going to make a difference in the standings, or whether I was going to talk directly to the voters in Iowa and New Hampshire. And I decided I was going to talk directly to the voters in Iowa and New Hampshire at a time when they were going to start paying attention to this race. So that's what I'm going to do. And I think it is one foot in front of the other. I'm going to do one after another town hall in New Hampshire where I answer every single question and wait, you know, until the very end. I'm not here to talk to people. I'm here to learn what's on people's minds and answer their questions. And I think that'll work. It's worked before for candidates that have gone from where I'm standing in the polls. Gary Hart came out here three or four weeks ago to remind everybody that when he was running, he was at about 1% at the same time I was at 1%, and he managed to come in second in Iowa and win in New Hampshire. So I think we can do that.
That is Michael Bennett. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. My conversation with Joe Sestak, former admiral and congressman, is next. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Joe Sestak, former congressman and admiral in the Navy, an individual that has not received a lot of attention so far this primary cycle, but he hopes that all changes as he will walk across the Granite State, taking 8 days to do so, beginning on the west side of the state and ending in the eastern side of the state in Portsmouth. He will start on Sunday, and he stopped into the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio earlier this week. So we'll start with this, and I think it's kind of the first and foremost question. You're a former admiral, and do you feel like this field, the media, the Democratic establishment has left qualified, credible individuals behind and is trying to move the narrative to the top tier candidates, particularly with how the elimination process is working? What are your feelings?
The answer is yes. Look, we have a tier of candidates right now, but there are two things that are missing. Most important, if there's one objective that we have to accomplish and really is our only choice, is to elect somebody who can actually unite this nation again. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can get in and be president, but if all you can do is do executive orders like the last 2 years of a fine president, President Obama, and then the next gentleman rips them out, and then that happens again, America's just going to go sideways. And second, where is the depth and breadth of foreign policy experience so that people who are become commander-in-chief understand that if you're going to use our military, you better know how it's going to end before you decide it's going to begin, which Democrats and Republicans alike didn't understand when they voted for that tragic misadventure in Iraq. So when I got in, after my daughter's brain cancer finally receded a second time in June, I got in for those reasons. I got in to help unite this country once again. But I also know this, to what you said, the establishment, particularly the media on the Eastern Seaboard, has deemed, well, you know, you're late. Wait a minute, same month Bill Clinton got in,
right?
A couple years ago.
Right.
But all of a sudden, they kind of say, these are the ones that we'll play with. I've got a memo, actually, Chris, from one of the three cable news sent by a friend 2 days after I got in. That wasn't mean. It just said, Joe Sestak, former congressman, former admiral, but we think he's late to get in, and we're not going to interview. So that's why I'm very appreciative for the opportunity here today. I can't complain. I just got to work harder.
Right. But imagine if, say, Michelle Obama decided that she was going to run for president in October. I'm pretty sure that the three major outlets would be interested in talking to Michelle Obama or Tom Hanks or whoever else.
To some degree, it's kind of unfortunate. There's this wonderful book that called Leadership that was written in 1978 and began to say that where are the titans who once strode the stage of statecraft and public office? He said, today we're beginning to become more, and this is 1978, more where it's about personality.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, if you get in and you have that one thing, all of a sudden it's wow. But it's okay, I think, because I honestly believe what Americans are looking for. You know, as I went, drove 17,000 miles in 3 months, that's six times across the United States, living out in a Econo Lodge all throughout Iowa, and now I'm here for a month doing about 100 events, walking. I'm 105 miles to begin a walk across Pennsylvania to meet everyone that, you know, when I meet with people, yeah, okay, some are caught up in the glitz of a personality or with the latest ideology somebody puts out, but I honestly think they are yearning to go back to the days where somebody could talk with them and was practical and could say, you know, I serve this country.
Yeah,
I'd like to serve you again above party itself or any special interest.
Yeah, our next guest on the show, Michael Bennett, senator from Colorado, I think is kind of in the same realm as you. These incredibly qualified, smart individuals that deserve to have a role in the process that are being excluded because of lack of a name ID and lack of ability to raise a significant amount of cash. And I think the process is actually going to get worse and is going to get people really upset here soon when the threshold gets raised again and you see somebody like, you know, an Amy Klobuchar or an Andrew Yang or Tulsi Gabbard, who are polling well in early primary states, get excluded from the debate potentially because of a lack of of donors. And it's wrong. And I think, you know, you bring up a really good point about how this has become an entertainment realm. This is that's what this is all about at this point. And if that were the case, we would have never seen many of our greatest presidents, including Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt, and perhaps even Teddy. Well, Teddy was pretty entertaining. I'm going to keep him in the mix. But Franklin Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln would have never become president of the United States, in my view, in this current political environment.
Look, Abraham Lincoln lost 9 elections or efforts to have public office. And look, although some may deem that I am late in June and don't have, you know, perhaps been on the political horizon for a number of years after I left Congress, is I believe my ideas are timely. And look, I will walk in across New Hampshire. Very low unemployment rate. Got that. But if you count those who have lost the workforce in New Hampshire, left the workforce in New Hampshire, and can't find a job because they don't have the skills anymore, the unemployment rate in New Hampshire would actually be 7.6%.
Yeah.
Across America, we have 12 million Americans who have lost their job and don't have the skills to get the next job because technology changes so rapidly. We spend less than any developed nation on the labor force, those who use their mind and their hands. 65% of our citizens don't have a college degree, and that's mighty fine. They are the skilled workforce that drive this. But who's taking care of them in a sense of the next skill they need to learn when you're kicked out of a coal mine? So when I walk across this state, those are the kind of issues I want to hear about and talk about because they're the ones, I believe, that actually have begun to lose trust in a government that, to a large degree, doesn't care about people first, cares about an ideology or how's my personality coming across.
And
as
where
I'm
is the money coming in?
Absolutely right.
And I think that you bring up really good points about the apathy of the American public. And you're right. I mean, there's some folks that come to events, but for the large part, most people will never, ever even think about attending a political event. And, you know, there's about half of America doesn't even vote. So the apathy, I think, is a really important issue. And I think that the type of vitriol and the type of political discussion that is taking place is pushing more and more individuals to the sidelines. And as a result of that, the loud voices are rising to the forefront and are dominating the conversation.
Which then just turns off more people.
Exactly. And so what we need in this country is to address an apathetic middle. And because we're in trouble. And you know, it's a democracy if we can keep it.
You know, I was asked in an interview one time, why aren't you running on outrage? I said, because I want to run as I'm going to govern.
Right.
And if you're running an outrage and putting the other side down, how will you ever unite this country? Second, to your point, when I walk across this state, I'm going to go into small businesses. I'm going to go to see those who do manufacturing. I'm going to go into a mental health institution that takes care of our veterans. I've asked to visit the prison here because as a congressman, I used to go and visit my vets, who many are there in Grady Ford Max Security Prison where I had my district. And they came home in Vietnam, PTSD, we didn't even know what it was. I'm going to go and actually go to meet teachers and others, going to that middle, to where the Americans really are. Mm-hmm. And I think everywhere I go, and I'm not just saying this, heads nod like this when I say, look, our biggest task today is to bring this nation back together again, just like John F. Kennedy or Ronald Reagan mm-hmm. did. You can disagree, but we can disagree well, mm-hmm. particularly if people understand that you're willing to bear the consequences of voting or doing something that matters for people above party.
That is Joe Sestak joining us here in the program, former congressman, admiral, and current Democratic presidential candidate. This hour, the program is presented by New England College, as well as the Prescription Center, and this segment of the show brought to you by Paradigm Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning. New Hampshire primary interviews on the program presented by Rath Young and Pignatelli and rathlaw.com. Brought up a key point in regards to the workforce, skills, and education. This is a theme we've been talking about here over the last couple of weeks here on the program, and I feel like our education K-12 system needs to be dramatically changed, because you're talking about the skills side of things. Skills, to me, need to be a part of the K-12 education environment. Yes. Introducing the jobs of now and the jobs of the future, a recognition that the economy has drastically changed, and there are all these problems that exist out there, which should be viewed under the spectrum of what we are as our country and the idea of America, and you know how much, in my view, better the American form of government is than any other. But that being said, there's a lot of work to be done. But nobody wants to do. There's so many different ways to look at this. But it seems like nobody wants to do the work because it's difficult and because it also can be seen as being a problem the next election. If you do something big, there's going to be ripple effects from that. And you look at the Affordable Care Act as an example. That was the last really big piece of legislation. And how big was it? It affected 20% of the healthcare individuals that have healthcare in the country. But it seems that there is a lack of willingness to do the big things.
Without a question. Look, I was in Congress. I got out of the Navy. My daughter had brain cancer 4 years old when mm-hmm. I came back from the war, having been on the ground for a brief period in Afghanistan, then commanded a carrier battle group. But my daughter survived glioblastoma, what John McCain had, mm-hmm. what Ted Kennedy had. My payback tour of my country was go to Congress in a nearly 2-to-1 Republican district. I ran on National Security Begins at Home and Health Security. I went down there to fight in 2005 for what finally came out, the Affordable Care Act. I had 10 town halls with the Tea Party. I got there early and shook everyone's hand as they came in. They got upset with me, but in the last time, they said, "Can we have a picture with you?" They didn't vote for me, but I was there willing to say,
right,
"Listen, I'll listen to you, but let me explain why I did this." You don't find that politicians today are willing to be accountable to people on what needs to be done. You talk about training. My gosh, there used to be the VoTech program where you would be able to, as I tried to do in Congress, to get VoTech credits in high school mm-hmm. to count towards community college credits. So they began a pathway to a skill. Why aren't we getting back to what's needed today? Think about, as I went back, to those coal miners that are going to lose mm-hmm. their jobs as we work towards green energy. Why aren't we, when they're kicking out, continue lifetime for training to train them in green energy? I just read to this morning in Wall Street Journal, which I knew, that Germany had one of the best apprentice programs of those artisans, work with their hands and their minds. 15 years old in high school, you begin an apprenticeship if you want to. Mm-hmm. But their population is going down, and a lot of people don't want to go into that anymore, and they're having challenges. If anything, we need them more today than anywhere, because we should be creating, not China, the solar power panels that are eventually going to be everywhere. And I think that we're missing it, because right now we're worried about college loans. Wait a moment. I can worry about them, but there's a program in government that says if we make it mandatory for everybody, mm-hmm. you don't have to pay back more than 10% of your income. After you deduct from your income the equivalent of the poverty level of income, 150% of that, we can make things work. But let's focus not just on that. Let's focus on the workforce who made America great, the artisans.
Do you feel that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are divisive figures, or are they ones that can bring the country together?
What I believe is this. They have good ideas, but I learned in the military, piss-poor planning means piss-poor execution. Mm-hmm. So when you saw on that debate stage where they were asked the question, who's here for Medicare for All? And every hand was shot up in the air almost. That's what I said to somebody later when they asked me, a journalist, what would you have done? I would say, that's the wrong question. How can you get there and prove to people that it's the right things right. to do? And so what I think is, whether it's the student loans, is there a better way to do it than just forgiving them? Or is there a way to get to Medicare for All by testing it? Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. 5 out of about 13 rural hospitals here in New Hampshire are going to disappear, they believe, in the next 10 years. We're going to lose about 500 across this nation because for-profit hospitals aren't going into the rural counties. They're mm-hmm. leaving it.
Right.
Medicare for All is based on for-profit hospitals.
Right.
Well, why don't we have a public option that begins to test, to see a model that takes us slowly towards, for the rural counties, something like a VHA, a mm-hmm. veterans hospital, mm-hmm. who has been rated by the New England Journal of Medicine as having, in the 11 major indices of healthcare, the best provision, equal to or better than any private one. I know they got the problems, but so does the others.
Yeah.
So why don't we test that to see if we can move towards that, not by mandating in 2 to 4 years, but by testing it, seeing if it works, and if it does, move towards it. That's what we have to do for Medicare for All.
Yeah.
And what I'm worried about is that people have an idea or an ideology, excite the people, but then all of a sudden you're down there in Congress, and can you unite this country to get it passed? I mean, in the White House.
Right.
And number two is, do you make sure you treat people well as you're trying to transform something? Because 255 million Americans, some form of private health care.
Right. No, I think you have a really good point. To me, Medicare for All is hugely problematic, because if we were starting our own country, yeah, it makes perfect sense, but we're not. And the fact of the matter is that Elizabeth Warren can tell folks that it's going – well, first off, she's not being honest with individuals about how their middle-class taxes are going to go up. But then she'll say that your overall costs will go down. That's maybe true on average, but that is not true for each American. Some individuals have great private insurance through their employer, and the fact of the matter is when their costs are going to go up as a result of a Medicare for All. And the effects that it's going to have on the overall economy, eliminating private insurance, there's the effects, and then there's the actuality. Gene Shaheen and Maggie Hassan are not going, and neither is Chris Pappas or Annie Custer, our 4 Democratic members of Congress, are not going to support Medicare for All. And they're not going to do so because of the effects that it's going to have. You cannot just have that type of a radical change. And I completely agree with you, whether it's a public option, whether it's a VA type of public option, whether it's Pete Buttigieg's Medicare for All That Want It type of plan.
I call it a transition of choice.
Exactly. Exactly. Folks, let folks make the – don't tell them what they should do as government. Don't take away their what they may like or not like. Let the American people make a decision on whether or not they want Medicare for All. Give them a public option in order to – bring down cost, let them make that choice for themselves, as opposed to mandating it and potentially creating a huge economic problem in our country by mandating it.
Here's something else I strongly believe also. As you start to look abroad also, we are talking about a climate change challenge that people will say, well, we need the new Green Deal.
Right.
Now look, first of all, we have to be realistic that we have to address this issue. Number two, that we have to show leadership in it, but we have to have a pragmatic plan to get to it, much like we did for acid rain, where we used a market mechanism to bring down acid rain, which is why I'm for a carbon fee dividend. Mm-hmm. However, this is the major point. 85% of greenhouse emissions come from abroad. Saudi Arabia will use as much electricity to power its air conditioning in 10 years as it exports in oil today. And so if 194 of 196 nations are not meeting the Paris climate commitment, including us, it requires someone to be able to convene the world to say, we're all in this together. Because if we're just doing it by ourselves, then that means that catastrophic bomb, when it does eventually explode, we'll have 85% of the fragments from it explode upon us because 85% of the damage comes from abroad. Now, you can, to me, is you really have to also look at this world as one world today, whether mm-hmm. whether it's an authoritarian China that's beginning to contract our American dream, or whether it's this challenge I believe that we have in climate change. And we have to make sure that we're honest and upfront with the American people of what it's going to take in order to address such challenges, much like Medicare for All. How do you get there with a transition of choice, but also to see if it can work? And so if it does, then we can get there if it's lower cost, better health care, easier access.
Final thing, you mentioned pragmatism, and I strongly believe in pragmatic, thought-based approaches to problems, compromise. Jeb Bradley has a great saying, don't let perfect be the enemy of the good.
Right.
And I'm not sure Jeb's trademarked that one, but it will.
I've heard it.
He says it a lot. That to me is a major issue in our country right now as well, where people want politicians understand that you're able to. I had this conversation with John Kasich in 2016, where he's like, I'm not going to go up there and give people red meat and just tell them I'm going to do things I can't do, because what's the point of that? But we have totally moved in that direction, where it was, we're kind of getting back to the entertainment portion of things, where you yell about Medicare for All, you tell people there shouldn't be any billionaires. And I've talked with Bernie about this, and I'm like, are you making promises? Are you making guarantees? Are you guaranteeing Medicare for All, there's not going to be any billionaires? Like, no, there's no guarantees in life. But it is like he's making guarantees, and a lot of folks take it as that, and they see his candidacy, and they look at the fact that they may not have a lot of hope, same thing with Donald Trump. And if a person is telling them that things are going to be better and you're not going to have to pay for college anymore, your student loans are going to be wiped out, free health care, that's a big reason to vote for somebody. But the fact of the matter is that it is going to be extremely difficult for Bernie Sanders to deliver on any of his promises. Same thing with Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, look, the biggest deficit we have in America today is not the debt. It's the trust deficit.
You're so right.
Because we have seen...
And it's only going to get worse if people get elected. And
it's exactly right. So what you have is politicians, Democrats and Republicans, for example, who voted for that tragic misadventure in Iraq. And they, two decades later almost, are not now holding themselves accountable for the carnage that has arisen, as it was our invasion that went in and former General Saddam Hussein created ISIS, for example. Then they tore down the one place that, a wall is needed to keep greed out and accountability in, Wall Street. And I had to keep my office open 7 days a week to 9 o'clock every night to try to save at least 800 homes for people who were losing in that Great Recession after Democrats and Republicans alike voted to tear down the safeguards that the unfettered Wall Street then destroyed my constituents' livelihood. But not one politician has ever been accountable for themselves for what they did. So that's why we have this lack of trust today. And if you're running and all of a sudden you say, this is what's going to happen when I get in office, first off, can unite the country to get both sides to come together to agree to do that, which has to be done, because who wants another president just to executive orders when the next rips it out? And second of all, if you lose trust that you can't do it, or don't do it, or it doesn't work, then you've only added to that lack of trust that is tearing, I think, America apart. I tell people, Mr. Trump's not the problem. He's the symptom of a problem where we no longer have people as accountable, public officials accountable to people above self, above party, above any special interest. That is what we have to restore.
Some logistics of your walk across New Hampshire. So you're going to walk 100 miles from the border of with Vermont all the way to the seacoast. So how many miles are you planning on walking each day?
It varies depending upon the kind of events I'm going to be doing. But some days are 18, some days are 12, but it takes 8 days is what they've...
It's going to take 8 days to get across.
8 days walking across. It'll start to rain on the first day. I did 422 miles when I walked across Pennsylvania by foot. But I have to tell you, whether I was an admiral and the planes came home from Afghanistan or Iraq... At 3 or 4 a.m. in the morning, I went down to the mess decks, and I sat there with the troops, because my guys were and gals were back from combat. And I sat down, just ate with them to calm down, chat with them and all. And I always remembered this, that great book I used to read to my daughter with my wife, To Kill a Mockingbird. Mm-hmm. The Scout's father, Atticus, said, you can't know a man until you stand in his shoes and walk around in them. I don't care if it's out there in combat where I used to go to board ships with my guys with, you know, mm-hmm. carrying assault weapons, or whether it's here at home, to walk in the shoes of constituents. How else are you going to earn the sailors' trust? How else are you going to earn the people's trust to your issue? Who wants to be in office and say you're going to do something and then can't make it happen? What kind of accountability is that?
That is Joe Sestak. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan with Paul Steinhauser. Paul is in Manchester, where he sat with one of the three individuals who are primarying Donald Trump, Joe Walsh, former congressman from Michigan.
Yep, and of the three, he's definitely the most vocal when it comes to Donald Trump and when it comes to anything else, because like my good friend here, Chris Ryan, Joe Walsh, after serving one term as a congressman, he got elected in that Tea Party wave back in 2010. After that, he's basically been a conservative talk show host for many, many years. He has the gift of gab, like Chris Ryan. And he definitely was gabbing a lot as we sat down the other day. And I started by asking him about this power move by the Trump re-election campaign and the Republican National Committee to tighten their grip over the delegate selection process to the convention, which would come at the expense of these primary challengers. Take a listen.
I think the Republican Party knows Trump's in trouble. I think they know he's weak. I think they know he's basically imploding every week. So they're doing whatever they can to protect him. It's undemocratic. It really is.
They say they're doing this out of position of strength. You disagree?
Oh, God, no. They're doing it because Trump wants them to do it. They're doing it because they know he's vulnerable. They don't want a primary challenge. Because look, he's going to be impeached. He should be impeached. He's going to be a disaster if he's at the top of our ticket next year. The Republican Party's going to do whatever they can to protect him. That's what they're doing.
Talking about impeachment, you've had some strong language in the last couple days. I mean, Basically calling him a traitor. Charges of what? A treason almost?
No, and I was very clear on CNN with Jake Tapper. Mm-hmm. Unlike Bill Weld, who I love and respect, no, I don't want this president hung for treason. Okay. Our founders were very specific about what treason meant. This isn't treason. But broadly defined, Trump's a traitor. When you invite and or pressure a foreign government to screw around with our elections, that's a betrayal of this country. Trump's done that from the moment he got elected. He's probably the most disloyal president this country's ever had. I mean that.
What's your path forward? I mean, you got to be realistic. You look at the polls.
Yeah.
You and the other two guys, Sanford and Weld, are the longest of longest of long shots. The president's approval ratings among Republicans here and elsewhere, sky high. So what's your path forward?
Soft. His support is soft. You see that 80-90% number? That's Republicans who there are also 50-60% of Republicans want there to be a primary challenge. And it doesn't count the people who've left the Republican Party because of him. I was in New Hampshire 2 weeks ago, probably spoke to 60 to 80 Republicans on the ground. Almost everyone said, yeah, I'm sick of it. Yeah, I'm exhausted with him. But what else am I going to do? I hear that over and over. I think it's soft. I think they need an alternative.
And one note, after I talked to Walsh, I had a chance to follow up with Mark Sanford, the South Carolina former governor and congressman. As you heard right there, Walsh said he wasn't taking Sanford's candidacy seriously. Sanford pushed back and said, listen, if you're not discussing the issues, what are you talking about? It's all about the issues, he said, in the race for the White House. Chris?
Yeah, what's also interesting is that we're seeing this impeachment process play out, and things will perhaps change in terms of the feeling about Donald Trump after the primary dates. So if the process is one that is locked in with support for Trump and doesn't allow for delegate movement at the convention, that thwarts any efforts that could take place for a surprise candidate to move in and for there to be a convention coup that would remove Trump.
Yeah, that's a good point. And Sanford, I asked, at least in the short term, I said, does impeachment help you and the other long-shot GOP primary challengers? And he said, no, actually, right now what impeachment is doing is rallying the base and not just debates, but a lot of other Republicans around the president, and that he said that makes it harder for him and the other ones to kind of punch through their message.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan for Paul Steinhauser. Have a great rest of the night, everybody.